writes. The woman living in the house across the street from the university couldn't understand why her dog had been barking incessantly all summer. Lisa had lain there all season, rotting, and animals started eating her. When they found her body, her ankle was missing. Only one person was ever arrested and charged. So Lee became a state trooper, to honour Lisa. Nobody had a better reason to hate the drug gangs than she did. Nobody was more determined to stop them. A few years later, the Ku Klux Klan was marching through Elkton, a town of 15,000 people in rural Maryland. The men in white hoods were at the front, with 60 supporters in train, chanting, "Hey, hey, ho, ho, niggers have gotta go!" Anti-racist campaigners who turned up to counter-demonstrate were jeering and hurling objects like batteries at them and yelling abuse, but the Klan kept on going. And in the middle of the march, there was a proud Klanswoman in a white hood, Lee Maddox. She'd been helping to plan their marches and their picnics and recruiting people in the street for a year now. Near her, in another neat white hood, was the head of this Klan chapter's chief henchman, a man who had committed murder 20 years before and been let off when he pled insanity. Lee continued marching through a hail of batteries. Her bosses told her that women couldn't infiltrate the Klan because it's too dangerous, but she insisted. She explained that she believed they were burning crosses outside the homes of African Americans in Elkton and threatening violence against them, so the police need somebody in there. Eventually, because she insisted for so long, her bosses gave in. But for Lee, it was doubly risky, because she was going home from the Klan rallies to her black boyfriend. Her undercover Klan name was Rosa Lee. Women rarely turned up at Klan rallies alone, so she had to invent a boyfriend who was living far away and couldn't be with her. She was forced to find something to talk to these people about, so she burrowed hard to find something good about them, or at least something she shared. One of the Klansmen knew a lot about plants, and she liked nature, so they discussed that. Another liked Coors Light. She isn't much of a beer person, but she imagined that if she were... Yes, this was hard going. But she was gathering intelligence that was vital to the safety of black people in this town. One day, in broad daylight, two of the Klansmen were driving through Elkton when a black guy pulled up next to them at an intersection, with a white girl next to him. Her comrades from the Klan grabbed a length of lead pipe, dragged him from the vehicle, and beat him close to death. Lee was able to identify them from the witness reports, so they were taken off the streets. And this went on. She was able to tell the police which vehicles to stop on the way to the rally that would contain illegal guns, drugs, and who was driving under the influence. She was giving intelligence almost in real time. The Klan soon began to panic. Is there a snitch? How else could the police know this much?
Which one of you motherfuckers is telling the cops everything?
After one Klan meeting, the men asked Rosa Lee to stay behind and accused her, outright, of being a cop. Lee knew these were felons and psychopaths with a history of violence and killing. She felt sick. All she could do to have a chance of surviving was to lash out.
"You are a bunch of goddamn motherfuckers," she yelled. "I can't believe that after all this time and all I've done for this organization, you would dare question my loyalty. I'm beginning to think you guys are a bunch of losers. I don't even know why I hang out with you."
They started to insist. "We want to see your house. We need to see your grandparents." Lee had to think fast.
"You guys want to come down and see my house? Seriously? You want to come down and see my grandmother on a Sunday without notice? You know how ill my grandmother is, and you guys are not exactly the kind of guys she would want me to bring around."
But they insisted. She had to agree. There was no choice.
"Fine, fine,"
she said. She told them to follow her car, and then sped away faster than she had ever driven in her life. Lee would always know she made a difference in Elkton, getting violent racists put away. Thanks to her, fewer Americans were terrorized. It wasn't easy being a female cop in those days, but Lee was proving she had balls, and she had some crucial allies. She drove the 90 miles to work every morning, talking to her colleague Ed Totley, a goateed African-American undercover narcotics agent who had grown up just outside Baltimore. He was head of the union, and he stood up to the encrusted sexism on the force as Lee rose higher and higher, cracking a series of glass ceilings. Yet the work Lee was most driven by was taking on the drug gangs. This was what got her out of bed in the morning. She was sure that her roadside stops and drug busts were disrupting the supply routes through Maryland, and this meant that there would be fewer gangsters, fewer addicts, less violence, and less misery in the world. This is one of the important facts about Lee, and one that it would be easy for somebody like me, with the politics that I have, to ignore. Lee's support for the drug war was an act of compassion. She genuinely believed that she was making the world a better place by protecting people from drugs and drug gangs. She is a kind and decent person, and that is what drove her to fight the drug war. She pictured Lisa, and fought for her. Yet all over the United States, all over the world, police officers were noticing something strange. If you arrest a large number of rapists, the amount of rape goes down. If you arrest a large number of violent racists, the number of violent racist attacks goes down. But if you arrest a large number of drug dealers, drug dealing doesn't go down. Another police officer, Michael Levine, was learning this lesson for himself. As he made clear when I interviewed him in 2011, as with Lee, the drug war was personal for him. His brother died of a heroin overdose in Harlem in the 1950s. His son was a cop murdered by a drug addict in the 1980s. So when he was told to go to one of the most notorious drug-selling corners in Manhattan, near the top of 92nd Street, and clean up that damned corner once and for all, he was delighted. In a long surveillance operation, his team identified 100 likely street dealers within 50 feet who work from the moment the sun falls to the moment the sun rises. Within 2 weeks, he had busted around 80% of them. He was satisfied, and for a couple of days, there was less drug activity. But within a week, everything was back to normal. As if we had never been there, as Levine puts it in his writing. Why? Because, as every dealer knows, if he's arrested, there are hundreds right behind him ready to take his place. He asked himself, if all those cops and agents couldn't get this one corner clean, what is the purpose of this whole damned drug war? Back on the roads running into Baltimore, Lee was discovering something that was going to change her life. It was even worse than Levine suspected. It's not just that arresting dealers doesn't cause any reduction in crime. Whenever her force arrested gang members, it appeared to actually cause an increase in violence, especially homicides. At first this puzzled her, but it was a persistent pattern. Why would arresting drug dealers cause a rise in murders? Gradually, she began to see the answer. So what happens is, we take out the guy at the top, Lee explains. So now there's nobody in charge, and so the gangs battle it out to see who's going to be in charge. As I try to understand this, I imagine if Chino had been put away for a really long stretch or killed, the demand for drugs in Flatbush would not be reduced. There would still, every day, be people turning up on his corner in search of drugs. So there would either have been a war within Souls of Mischief to see who would be the new top dog, or a rival gang, like the older men whom they drove out that day, would have sensed weakness and swept in to fight for control of the patch. In the fighting or the crossfire, it's easy to see how there would be killing. Is that right? Is this why every crackdown triggers a turf war? I went away and read through the studies, trying to discover if what Lee witnessed is part of a wider pattern. Professor Jeffrey Myron of Harvard University has studied the murder statistics and found that statistical analysis shows consistently that higher police enforcement against drug dealers is associated with higher homicide, even controlling for other factors. This effect is confirmed in many other studies. So, Lee was beginning to realize that while she went into this job determined to reduce murder, she was, in fact, increasing it. She wanted to bust the drug gangs, but in fact, she was empowering them. In her heart, she suspected this had been the case for years, but she tried to avoid seeing it for as long as she could, until one night she was left with no choice. One job in policing is, everyone told me, pretty consistently the toughest gig. Ed Totley, the union head who championed Lee as she rose through the force, had to pretend every day to be a drug dealer among drug dealers. Back in the 1950s, Harry Anslinger had described what it takes to do this job. An undercover agent, he said, must be a better actor than an Academy Award winner, quick on his feet, even faster with his hands, and 10 times as fast with his mind. He plays his part as if it were reality itself. For weeks, or months, even years, he may live with the narcotic gangsters whom he will one day bring before a jury. He becomes part of the gangster's intimate life and family. The world in which he lives on assignment is one of violence. One slip, one false word, could cost his life. When they were being honest with themselves, Lee and Ed admitted they were both adrenaline junkies. There's nothing like knowing you almost died and spending the next half hour saying, "But I didn't," Lee told me, laughing. So she wasn't surprised when, on the morning of October 30th, 2000, Ed told Lee how excited he was. He had finally been given the order to take out a mid-level dealer he'd been tracking for 6 months. He was given $3,000 to head to Washington, D.C., buy a kilo of cocaine, and do the bust. "This is like the pinnacle of my career," he said. That night, Lee got a call from the duty sergeant. He was brief. As Ed handed over the $3,000, the 24-year-old dealer didn't hand him cocaine. He shot him, straight in the head. "I didn't give it a second thought," he said later in court. A few minutes later, as she was hurrying to the hospital, her major called her. "Lee, this is Mike," he said, and all she could say was, "Who the fuck is Mike?" She couldn't process anything. When she arrived at the emergency room, more than 100 police officers were there. Ed was the head of the union and a popular man. As soon as they heard, they all came. One of them put his hand on Lee's shoulder and said, "Lee, man, he's gone." Her chief appeared and said, "This is going to be hard, but you got to be strong for the troops. They need your leadership right now." The cops were waiting in line to see Ed's body, and Lee joined them. His head was wrapped in an improvised turban to keep his brains from spilling out. His body was still warm and soft when she touched it. Years from that day, Lee would explain in a speech, "As I rested my hand on his chest, I said a prayer for his family, his friends, and for myself. And as I did so, I felt the presence of every police officer who had lost their lives to the war on drugs. I felt the presence of my dear friend Lisa, and every other victim caught in the crossfire of our failed policies. I felt them in that darkened hospital room with me. Their spirits were careening down from the walls. Their spirits were jeering and mocking me. Justice?
Justice? What is this of your justice?
It was, she says, my Damascus moment. Lee tried to get back to work, but this time she knew too much. It's hard to be Harry Anslinger with your eyes and your mind open. She'd believed that by fighting the drug war, she was crushing the drug gangs that had killed her two closest friends. Now she began to see that her work, in fact, kept them in business and made them more deadly. The lesson of ending alcohol prohibition, she had come to believe, is that there is a way to actually stop this violence. Legalize and regulate the drug trade. After he was told about the killing, Ed's five-year-old son Daniel insisted on leaving the hallway light on at night, so Daddy could find his way home. While Lee was studying for a law degree at night, another part of the drug war was slowly becoming clear to her. The shaft of light she had allowed in was illuminated more than she expected. She knew that drug use and drug selling are engaged in by all the racial groups in America. Hell, she smoked marijuana herself as a teen. But that's not who she was arresting and imprisoning. In 1993, National Household Survey on Drug Abuse found that 19% of drug dealers were African American, but they made up 64% of the arrests for it. Largely as a result of this disparity, there was an outcome that was more startling still. In 1993, in the death throes of apartheid, South Africa imprisoned 853 black men per 100,000 in the population. The United States imprisons 4,919 black men per 100,000 versus only 943 white men. So, because of the drug war and the way it is enforced, a black man was far more likely to be jailed in the land of the free than in the most notorious white supremacist society in the world. Indeed, at any given time, 40 to 50% of black men between the ages of 15 and 35 are in jail, on probation, or have a warrant out for their arrest, overwhelmingly for drug offences. It's easy to assume that Harry Anslinger's prejudices at the birth of the drug war were just a product of their time, long since discarded. Lee was discovering they are not. The race panics that drove the early drug war have not burned out. But here again, I was forced by Lee and by the facts to see that this is not a simple story with straightforward heroes and villains. I was inclined to assume that this hugely disproportionate rate of arrest of black men is due to naked racism on the part of cops. But Lee is not a racist. We know this because she risked her life to expose violent racism. And most of her colleagues, she said with confidence, were not racist, and they would have been appalled if any of their colleagues made racist statements. Yet Lee was, as she would see later, acting as part of a racist machine, against her own intentions. Around this time, other police officers across the United States were trying to figure out how this works, too. Matthew Fogg is one of the most decorated police officers in the United States, responsible for tracking down more than 300 of the most wanted felons in the country, from murderers to rapists to child molesters. But he was bewildered as to why his force only ever goes to black neighborhoods to bust people for drugs. He went to see his boss to suggest they start mounting similar raids in white neighborhoods. He explained in a speech that his superior officer told him, "Fogg, you know you're right, they're using drugs there, but you know what? If we go out and start targeting those individuals, they know judges, they know lawyers, they know politicians, they know all of the big folks in government. If we start targeting them and their children, you know what's going to happen? We're going to get a phone call, and they're going to shut us down. You know that, Fogg? You know what's going to happen? There goes your overtime. There's the money that you're making. So, let's just go after the weakest link. Let's go after those who can't afford the attorneys, those who we can lock up.
I kept trying to understand this dynamic, and the more cops I met, people who were not racist but had produced a racist outcome, the more it came into focus. More than 50% of Americans have breached the drug laws. Where a law is that widely broken, you can't possibly enforce it against every lawbreaker. The legal system would collapse under the weight of it. So you go after the people who are least able to resist, to argue back, to appeal. The poorest and most disliked groups. In the United States, they are black and Hispanic people, with a smattering of poor whites. You have pressure on you from above to get results. There has to be a certain number of busts, day after day, week after week. So you go after the weak. It's not like you're framing them. They are, in fact, breaking the law. You keep targeting the weak, and you try not to see the wider picture. But then, for some people, it becomes inescapable. Lee started to ask herself, how can you continue with this? But she felt an intense loyalty to her fellow officers, whom she knew to be good people. They were being increasingly sued by the American Civil Liberties Union, often personally, and her reflex was to defend them. These were men she had faced gunfire with for years. How could she walk off the battlefield? We humans are good at suppressing our epiphanies, especially when our salaries and our friendships depend on it. She knew that a big chunk of her police department's budget ran on the money they got from seizing drug suspects' property. What would happen to all their jobs if that were taken away from the cops? She deliberately kept herself so busy that I just didn't have any time to think about it. As she explained this to me, I realized that for Chino and for Lee, all the incentives laid out by Prohibition were to keep on fighting their wars and shooting their guns and ignoring their doubts. But on I-95, Lee began to see the act of pulling over a car to search it in a new way. Once, she saw this scene as a soldier in a just war approaching the enemy. Now she sees it as a meeting of people who are surrounded by ghosts. As she approaches the car, the police officer has ranged behind him the ghosts of all the cops he has known. All the funerals he's been to, all the people who've been killed in traffic stops, because it's a lot, she says. And then, there's also this poor black kid in the car. Sitting in the passenger seats behind him are his ghosts, all of his relatives and friends who have been killed in police raids or vanished into the American prison system. Neither can see the other side's ghosts. They can only hate. One day, Lee discovered she was not alone. A friend told her about a group called Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, or LEAP, an organization of cops and judges and prison officers fighting to end the drug war so they can bankrupt the drug gangs. She was intrigued. She needed to find an answer to a question that was plaguing her. What had been the practical effect of all the policing she has done over the years? She decided to venture out into the drug war zones of Baltimore, not in uniform this time, but as a civilian. She looked at the kids in the city and talked with them. She discovered they are grown up in war zones. There's no doubt about it. There were prohibition-related killings almost every night, and the kids see it. All the kids know this. It traumatizes you to a point you can't begin to imagine. But perhaps most important, once you've been busted for a drug offense, at 15 or 17 or 20, you are virtually unemployable for the rest of your life. You will never work again. You will be barred from receiving student loans. You will be evicted from public housing. You will be barred from even visiting public housing. Say your mother lives in public housing, and you get arrested for possession and you go visit her, Lee says. If the housing authority find out you've been in there, they will say you violated the lease and they'll kick the whole family out.
I kept meeting people like this across the United States, second-class citizens, stripped even of the vote, because at some point in the past they possessed drugs. Lee was amazed to uncover all this. She explains, "When I was a police officer, nobody ever trained me on the collateral consequences of marijuana arrests. I had no idea. It's not something they're made aware of. It's, go out and get numbers. Do your job." Just as Jimmy Fletcher, the agent sent by Harry Anslinger to break Billie Holiday, never forgave himself for what he ended up doing to her, Lee Maddox never forgave herself for what she had done to all the kids she arrested over the years. It was not enough, Lee decided, for her to say she's sorry. You have to make amends. So she completed her retraining as a lawyer, quit her job as a cop, and started providing services in Baltimore to help the very people she'd been busting and breaking before. She set up a low-cost legal clinic called Just Advice, where she and her students fight to have the arrest records of accused drug offenders expunged any way they can. She writes to universities, imploring them to provide access to scholarships to students with drug convictions. She defends drug users in court. This is Lee's life now. It sounds like a neat ending to her story, but Lee is more downbeat and humble than that. She can't say, in all honesty, that she has found any redemption for herself, she tells me. No, because she keeps meeting the people you can't help under prohibition. The guy who comes in and he's 45 years old, and he has his criminal record with him, and he wants to get it expunged, and all you can say is, sorry, you're out of luck. To see that kind of distress in their eyes. She is up against a legal system in which even a famously liberal judge like Justice Thurgood Marshall would openly brag, "If it's a dope case, I won't even read the petition. I ain't giving no break to no drug dealer." In 2011, Lee drove to the city where Harry Anslinger launched his war long before, Washington, D.C. Not far from the old Federal Bureau of Narcotics building, she delivered a speech. "To those who urged the United States not to wave the white flag of surrender, I say, what white flag?" she asked. "Your white flag is now a red flag. A red flag sullied and stinking from countless deaths of good guys and bad guys and simple people caught up in the crossfire." Chapter 7 Mushrooms. Without really thinking about it, I guess I've always assumed that the people who die in the drug war are those who chose to enter it, dealers and users and cops. But I soon found out there is another category altogether. In Baltimore, I learned they call them mushrooms. Tiffany Smith was playing on the sidewalk as the light faded on a hot July night in West Baltimore in 1991. She was playing with her doll, Kelly, and her best friend, Quinietta. They were outside Quinietta's house, where they were going to have a sleepover. Her parents were watching from the porch. The Baltimore Sun recorded the details in the days that followed. It had been a fun day. They had been singing and clapping at a block party. Then they danced along to anti-drug songs performed by the group Parents, Students, Moving Against Drugs. And now this, sitting up in the heat with her doll and her friend. Tiffany's hair was tied into pigtails. In a few weeks, she was going to be 7 years old. Except she wasn't. We don't know if Tiffany saw the two young men at the corner. We don't know if Tiffany knew what a drug turf war is. We don't know if she heard the gunshot. Unlike Chino and Lee, and all the other people in this book, Tiffany didn't get to formulate a position on the drug war. I got a message through to her parents. They didn't want to talk. They call them mushrooms because they can pop up anywhere. They renamed the block where she died Tiffany Square. Today, it is a place where dealers openly sell drugs. Part 3. Angels. Chapter 8. State of Shame. By the summer of 2012, I had been working on this book for a year, and I felt like I was trapped in a strange, reoccurring dream in which I caught a glimpse of Harry Anslinger and Arnold Rothstein fleeing out the door every time I arrived at a drug war battlefield. I watched as Chino and Lee tried to be Anslinger and Rothstein, and failed. But I kept hearing about people across the world who had in fact succeeded in becoming these founding fathers, and then went further than they ever dreamed. They had, I realized, taken the darkest impulses I found and feared within myself and our culture, to repress addictive urges with violence, to crush in the belief you will conquer, and followed them, literally. I needed, I knew, to go looking for those men. I wanted to understand them. They might hold the key. So I booked a ticket to Arizona, and within a few days I was marching with a chain gang of meth addicts in the desert, all arranged by Harry Anslinger's personal disciple. Then I booked a flight to Texas and found myself in a bare prison cell, talking through reinforced glass to a young man who has sawed off heads for the great-grandchildren of Arnold Rothstein. Then I headed into the deadliest city in the world to track a dead woman's dream. The female chain gang meets at 5 o'clock every weekday morning, just as the sun is starting to rise over the Arizona desert. The women emerge unfed from the tents, surrounded by barbed wire, as they are ordered to put on T-shirts that display to the world why they are here. "I was a drug addict," it says in bold black letters you can read from a distance. I watched as they clamber into their striped uniforms, their limbs flailing with hunger and exhaustion. Then they put on leg irons. Then the guards order them to begin their chant. "Everywhere we go, people want to know who we are. So we tell them, we are the chain gang, the only female chain gang." They have to stamp their boots and jangle their chains in rhythm to the song, as though they are the chorus line in some dystopian Broadway musical. And so the march out into the desert heat begins. Some days they are made to bury dead bodies. Other days they are taken to football matches to be marched in front of the crowds at the start of the game, so people can jeer and boo and hiss. Today they clamber into a bus. They are being taken, they are told, to a parched, trash-strewn traffic island in the 110-degree heat and ordered to collect trash in front of signs urging people to vote for the politician who has pioneered this particular form of punishment. The women try to get out of the bus but keep tumbling into each other as the chains catch their feet. They always apologize, in small voices, as the other women hold them up. When they step out into the sun, the women are shoved a bottle of sunscreen. The expiration date on the bottle, I notice, is 2009, 3 years earlier. It comes out as a thick paste. One girl is free of the chains. It is her job to nail into place a sign that says, "Caution, Sheriff's Chain Gang at Work," and to fetch water for women when they are on the brink of collapse. Gabba is a pale, bony, 19-year-old Italian-American. As I follow her around, she tells me that she was thrown out by her parents as a teenager and started using heroin. "It was my escape," she says, looking down. I can see Candace staggering around, looking phased. She is a blonde woman in her 20s, with an inflamed red face that looks as if it is being slowly eaten by something.
It is bleeding where she has scratched it too hard. The doctors have told her it's an allergic reaction to the bleach they use in the tents, she says, but there is no alternative for her. Her story comes out, like the other women's, in a matter-of-fact monotone. It's nothing special here. She ran away from her family when she was 14 and joined the carnival, and she started using meth there. It was the best thing I ever had in my life. It made the bad feelings go away, she told me, scratching. I'm afraid to get released because I don't know what I'm going to do. It numbs all the bad feelings. It makes me not feel anything. Like everyone else, Candace is sweating constantly in this heat, and the salt in her sweat is making the rash burn. The other T-shirts the women are forced to wear say, I am breaking the need for weed. Clean, ing, and sober. And meth user. Michelle, an older former meth user, says to me as she collects rubbish awkwardly, a lot of people didn't have a lot of dignity to begin with. To come here, and what they did have is taken away. Everything is about humiliating us until there's nothing left. A few hours after she tells me this, when she has been in the desert sun all this time, covered only with out-of-date paste, Michelle starts vomiting and shaking, and has to be held up by the rest of the chain. The day before, when I mentioned Harry Anslinger's name to the man who invented this chain gang, along with a slew of other ways to punish addicts, his face beamed big and wide. "Oh, wow! You're amazing!" he exclaimed. "It's amazing that you remember that man!" He had Harry's signature on his wall, staring down at him as he worked. To him, Anslinger was a hero, a role model, the man who started it all. He kept repeating Anslinger's name in our conversation as though stroking a purring cat. When you go back to Anslinger, you got a good guy here. Harry Anslinger employed Joe Arpaio in 1957 to be an agent in the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, and he rose through the Bureau over decades. Since 1993, he has been elected sheriff of Maricopa County, Arizona. He was 80 when I met him, and about to be elected to his sixth consecutive term. His Stetson, his shining yellow lawmaker's badge, and his sneer have become national symbols of a particular kind of funhouse mirror Americana, and his hefty chunk of Arizona, home to nearly 4 million people, is now Harry Anslinger's last great laboratory. Sheriff Joe has built a jail that he refers to publicly as his concentration camp, and presidential candidates flock here during election campaigns, emerging full of praise. Anslinger said addicts were lepers who needed to be quarantined, and so Arpaio has built a leper colony for them in the desert. I watch Gaba and Candace and Michelle and their fellow addicts march back into it in lockstep. Again, they have to chant, we're in a state of shame, couldn't get our lives straight. We're headed back to intake. We're here without our kids. We lost our hope. We gave up dope. The women look at me while they chant, then look away quickly. They have been ordered to look only at the back of the head of the person in front of them on the chain. It takes a moment for me to register what they are singing now. The guards have also ordered them to chant warnings that they will be given electric shocks if they dare to talk back. We're in stripes. They're in brown, meaning the guards. We walk in chains with them close by. We dare not run. We dare not hide. Don't you dare give them no lip, because they got tasers on their hip. This isn't an idle chant. In the jails and prisons of Arizona, several inmates have been tasered to death. As we stumble back into the bus and then back into the prison, the women are unshackled and strip-searched to see if they have any drugs in their vaginas or anuses. They live in tents that Arpaio got the military to donate for nothing.
Many of the tents are from the Korean War, and some are as old as a century, survivors of the First World War. At night you can hear the low scuttle of scorpions and the squeak of mice venturing out from the nearby trash dump. In the winter, it is freezing. In the summer, the heat hits you like an unimaginably vast hairdryer pointed at your face. Inside the tents, the temperature hits 140 degrees. The women go into the shower fully dressed to get soaked and then go lie on their beds. It takes an hour, and then you are bone dry again. But that, at least, is an hour in which you feel some relief. The first time I enter Tent City, the prisoners crowd around me, trying to desperately explain what is happening.
"This is hell!"
one of them shrieks. They are given two meals a day, costing 15 cents each. It is referred to by guards and inmates as slop, a brownish gloop of unspecified meat that used to be delivered in bags marked "Not for Human Consumption." People from the outside can give you money to buy small items from the commissary, like potato chips. But there are plenty of inmates who have nobody willing or able to give them money, so they live in a state of constant hunger. The prisoners are never allowed to touch their visitors. It all has to be done by video. Your children can be brought into a visiting room, but you will be handcuffed to the table and not allowed to touch them in any way, no matter what age they are. Even when the child cries, "Mama, Mama," and asks for a hug, the prisoner cannot reach out and has to watch her child crying, helpless. The guards, the women say, openly mock and abuse them.
"They think it's funny," one woman says, "to see us, Dan, to see us without our children."
Another tells me,
"It's like they're trained to be brutal."
As I walk through the tents, a cacophony hits me from all around. A diabetic 20-year-old, imprisoned for drinking alcohol, says he's not been given his insulin. Women, claiming the guards make them fight in the showers and film it, something that was proven to happen in California jails for years. Frightened cries from everywhere about being dispatched to some place called the Hole. The next day, I return to take down more details, but something has changed. The prisoners who hurried to me yesterday, full of pain, face away from me now. When I approach them in the tents, they are mute and simply shake their heads. I walk from one to another. They all refuse to talk, and when I keep asking, they try to shoo me away. The cacophony has been replaced by a perfect silence. One woman grabs at me as I pass and says that she's sorry she can't talk to me, but she'd like to shake my hand. As she does, I realize she is passing me a tiny folded note. I open it later.
"If I speak the truth to you, I will go to the Hole, and it's awful. You have nothing. Please understand, I'd like to talk to you, but I can't. They are watching us," it says. "We all got in trouble yesterday after you left. Please, don't let no one see this note."
I assume I will get no more information from Tent City, but, to my surprise, when I ask to see the Hole, the officers agree to show me. Everybody gives it this name, including the guards, although technically it is called an isolation unit. As I walk through the tents into the concrete heart of the prison itself, I see the Hole consists of a series of tiny concrete solitary cells laid out in rows on two different levels. The cell doors have a tiny slit in them, and as the guards unlock them, eyes peer out. When they see an outsider, they immediately start yelling for help, and their voices have a cracked quality, as though their throats are too narrow to let out their words. They are not allowed to communicate with the guards. They have to put anything they have to say in writing and slide it under the door. They are trying to talk to me. The first thing that hits me as I approach these eyes is the stink, literally, of shit. It is so overwhelming it makes me retch. The inmates let me peer past them into the cells. There is a steel bunk bed that would fit a 10-year-old child, and that's it. No radio, no life. The prisoners inside cannot see the sun or the sky or another human face. Some inmates are given a cellmate, and even though they can barely move with another person in there and have to shit in front of each other, they consider themselves lucky. As an inhabitant of the hole, you get 1 hour out of your cell to take a shower and stretch your legs. You can't communicate during that hour, and no phone calls are permitted. This is where you go if you break one of the rules Sheriff Joe has laid down, or if one of the guards takes a dislike to you. For example, he has banned cigarettes, so a woman is here, for a month, for being found with one. In one of the cells, on the top level in the corner, a woman is screaming. Hysterically, poundingly, her voice like a car alarm in the night. I can't make out what she is saying except for scattered words. But then I am told who it is. A young woman from Saudi Arabia. Strangely, she is the one person I spoke to the day I arrived who said something positive about Tent City. "It's making me not want to come back," she said. "Do you know what I mean? That's why they're hard on us. People can bitch all they want, but that's why they're hard on us." She is trying to tell me something now. The guards surround her cell. They tell me I can't speak to her, and that they have phoned a doctor. The other women shout to me that somebody tried to commit suicide here last night. "We heard the whole thing," one of them says. "She said to the D.O., directing officer, through the slit in her cell door, "Take the razor away," but the D.O. didn't listen. Then later we heard the D.O. say, "Holy shit!" The girl has been taken to the medical unit by the time I arrive. They say I can't speak to her. This use of solitary confinement is a standard punishment in American prisons. Not long before this, a mentally disabled man in another Arizona prison, called Mark Tucker, was kept in solitary for so many years, with his pleas for a cellmate refused, that he eventually set himself on fire. In the hospital, with 80% of his body burned, he was informed that the Department of Corrections was charging him $1.8 million to pay for the medical care to treat his injuries. In an office away from the tents, in the middle of the prison complex, I find a psychologist named Jorge de la Torre. His job is to provide some counseling for the women here. He has a weary air about him, as if he has misplaced something and can't quite find it. Some 90% of the inmates, he tells me, are here because of a drug-related problem. And virtually all of them are from traumatized backgrounds. They grow up with no alternatives, he says. They start with family problems they cannot manage. At any given time, Jorge can treat 1 in 100 of the prisoners. The rest are left with the guards and the hole. There is a properly built air-conditioned prison near Tent City, but Joe Arpaio has thrown these prisoners out of it and turned it into an animal shelter. Now dogs and cats relax in cool rooms, while addicts ache in the heat and dust storms outside. The animals, he believes, deserve it. When I explain Tent City to the people I sit next to on Greyhound buses, as I travel across the country, they say this must be a freakish outlier, a ghoulish parody of the wider prison network. But the more I traveled, the more former prisoners I met, and the more studies I read, it slowly became clear to me that this is in fact quite typical of how addicts are treated across the United States and around the world. I keep looking at the statistics. The United States now imprisons more people for drug offenses than Western European nations imprison for all crimes combined. No human society has ever before imprisoned this high a proportion of its population. It is now so large that if all U.S. prisoners were detained in one place, they would rank as the 35th most populous state of the Union. From the liberal state of New York to the liberal state of California, the jailing and torture of addicts is routine. To pick just one kind, the Justice Department estimates that 216,000 people are raped in these prisons every year. This is the number of rape victims, not the number of rapes. That is far higher. As the writer Christopher Glazek has pointed out, this means that the United States is almost certainly the first society in human history where more men have been raped than women. The rape of Chino's mother was not, it turns out, an unusual event in the war on drugs, and it happens to both genders. Nor is the United States alone. In China, addicts are often sent to hard labor camps, where they are forced to do back-breaking manual work as punishment. In Russia, Thailand, much of South America, the list goes on. This is all standard. Europe is slightly softer, and one ray of light has broken through, as I would see later. Sheriff Joe Arpaio is the corporate logo for this cruelty, but there is a whole range of cheap products lined up behind him, and they are bought by everyone. The drug war has turned the United States into a shining tent city on a hill, inspiring the world to imitation. As I try to understand what is really happening to drug users in Arizona, I talked with the handful of people who are working on improving prisoners' rights in the state, including Donna Leonie Hamm, the head of a group called Middle Ground Prison Reform. I asked her one of my standard questions. What in your work over the years has most shocked you? She started to reel off a long list, and around the middle of her litany, she referred, in passing, to a case where a woman was cooked in a cage, before continuing on. "Sorry, Donna," I said. "Can we go back a moment? Tell me about the woman who was cooked in the cage." Donna sent me to the archives, and the archives sent me on a journey across the United States to discover who this woman really was. Prisoner number 109416 woke up in her cell in Perryville State Prison Complex, Arizona, and said she felt suicidal. She was a small blonde woman in her 40s, with rotted teeth and sunken cheeks, whose thoughts often dissolved into a long stream of paranoid incoherence. She was here because a year ago, a man had approached her on the street in Phoenix and said he would give her a bag of meth if she gave him a blowjob. She said yes, and so she was detained close to death row prisoners. All her life, she'd been periodically caged, either for being addicted to drugs or for selling her body to get them. She was taken to see Dr. Susan Kaz, who was on duty in the prison that day. Kaz knew the prisoner had been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and was so badly mentally incapacitated that the courts had appointed a guardian to look after her interests. If proper notes had been kept, the doctors should have known that not long before, when 109416 was put in the hole in Tent City, she had swallowed a razor blade because, as her former cellmate Juliana Phillips said, she wanted to talk. Nobody would talk to her, and the guards treated her like shit. She just wanted a friend. But the doctor concluded that 109416 was being manipulative and just trying to get herself moved into another, less restrictive cell. So the guards took 109416 and put her in an outdoor cage in the desert. The cage was uncovered with the sun raging down. There was nothing in it. No water. No bench, no bed. It was 106 degrees. They are supposed to use this cage for a maximum of 2 hours per prisoner, but in practice, people are sometimes left there much longer. The cage was in direct sight of the guards. The prisoner asked for water. The guards mocked her for requesting it. One guard would later say the prisoner was spacey. All she cared about was coffee and cigarettes. Another would agree she was not all there. The prisoner shat herself. Nobody came to clean up the mess. The hours passed in the cage. 109416 was getting hotter and hotter and starting to burn up. She was screaming. The guards would say later, her shouting was something about Jay-Z and Beyoncé conspiring to kill her. At some point she collapsed, covered in her own shit. With her face against the floor of the desert, it sustained first-degree burns, as if she was in a fire. 16 different guards had the opportunity to do something. None of them responded. Here the story diverges. The guards claim they told her, "Don't lay down on the ground, it's too hard." But the prisoners say one of the guards was asked, "Did Pal really pass out when you tried to see her?" And he replied, "Yeah, it was the funniest thing. You should have seen it." Watching from a few stories up, the prisoners could see something terrible was happening. "We said, that girl's been laying there a long time and not moving. We saw guards walk past and nobody stopped." Her former cellmate, Juliana Phillips, tells me. "She was just laying there. Who's going to take a nap on the cement in the sun in polyester and no shade?" After the guards finally called an ambulance, the paramedics tried to take her temperature. Their thermometers only go to 108 degrees. She was that hot, or hotter still. Her internal organs had cooked, as if in an oven. At the hospital, they were legally required to call her court-appointed legal guardian before making medical decisions. They didn't. Instead, the prison warden came, and, according to the Phoenix New Times, he told the hospital just to switch her off. So she died, just before midnight. The autopsy found that her body was badly burned. Her eyeballs were, it was later explained, as dry as parchment. Three prison officers were fired soon after the incident. No prison officer involved ever faced charges. This is her story, as I found it in the records of the investigation into her death. The person in charge of this prison is not Joe Arpaio. This prison is run by the state, not the county. This way of treating addicts is much wider than him. It is statewide, and nationwide, and planet-wide. One of the men in charge of this particular prison, and those like it across Arizona, was Chuck Ryan, who worked all his life in the Arizona Department of Corrections, except for one interlude when he was a consultant for the Bush administration on how to handle the prison system in Iraq, a period that culminated in the Abu Ghraib scandal. Nobody knew much about prisoner number 109416. She was due to be buried in a pauper's grave at the prison until Donna's charity stepped in. She was stripped of an identity in death, just as she was stripped of an identity in the cage. But in 2012, I was able, with the help of the Arizona prisoners' rights campaigner Peggy Plews, to track down Richard Husman, the ex-boyfriend who fathered 109416's son, to Springfield, Missouri. We sit in a bar, and I hear his story. To him, she was Marcia Powell. Richard is a huge man with tattoos of flame covering his chunky, bulked-out arms. So it seems a little incongruous at first that he arrived clutching in his hand the picture of a child. He laid it in front of me. I put next to it all the records I have been able to find of Marcia, police interviews, court records, the accounts of her death. Together, we begin to stitch together the story of who she was. Marcia lived with her biological mother, he said, until she was about 3. After that, she spent 3 years in foster care until she was finally adopted. Something went wrong with the family who adopted her in California. She would never say what, but her adopted mother, as Richard put it, kicked her out when she was 13, and she'd been on the run ever since. She had nowhere to go but the beach. She was sleeping on the sand because it's warm, and nobody can throw you out. but your stuff is always stolen. You have to wash in the bathroom at McDonald's, and only if you're lucky. And you're afraid all the time that